As if the bigwigs at the Marcus Theater Corporation heard my complaints, one of the local theaters finally got the film The Shape of Water. And just for you folks, Alex and I went to see this film and then promptly recorded an episode. A warning though, there are some spoilers, so don't say I didn't warn you. So, we just got back from watching The Shape of Water, and what a weird movie.
Yeah. She fucks a fish man.
To put it bluntly and crassly.
She fucks a fish man.
That's true. Yeah, to give a little summary of the movie, this mute woman, played by Sally Hawkins, works at a secret government lab that starts experimenting on what is essentially the creature from the Black Lagoon in the old-timey monster movies. She ends up teaching it sign language. They bond. She learns they're going to kill it. So with the help of a ragtag group of friends, she helps break it free. And then, yeah, a little romantic bond forms between them. And that is where she then, has sex with a fish man.
Fucks a fish man.
Yeah, yeah. But what a good movie, though.
Yeah, no, it was really good. For a movie that probably not originally conceptually is based on this, but really is just based on the idea, how do we get a woman to fuck a fish man? Like, what a well-made film. Especially as, like, a period piece.
That's like, true.
They said it very concretely in the 1960s, during the Cold War. they do a good job kind of discussing the political climate and the social climate. By bringing things up like Russia and Russia's relationship with America, especially with the space race, and bringing up the racial tensions that were going on at the time, the outright racism that was going on at the time, and also a little bit of like the homophobia of the time and the struggles of gay men at the time. Which is interesting.
True, that's Richard Jenkins that's playing the gay man, who I think did a great job. He's nominated for Best Supporting Actor now.
Good job, dude.
Yeah, which I get why.
Yeah, like, he did a good job. He, like, played a gay man whose thing wasn't being a gay man. He was more like, he was a starving artist, essentially. Which is cool. Like, it's always cool to see well-done gay characters, because sometimes you just get gay characters that are gay and that's their thing. But he felt really fleshed out, and I like that.
That's true. Another thing was, this movie felt oddly very French.
Yeah, it did.
Between the score and then...
the French theater owner. That she
was
lives
he
above?
French?
He sounded French.
I thought he was, like, Polish or something.
Maybe
weird.
I just thought he was French because he, like, owned a theater.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, yeah, the beginning, maybe 10 minutes or so, I know you haven't seen this film yet, but it felt like Amelie to me. We get a kind of quirky character,
mm-hmm.
This quirky woman who's just... and I don't mean this to demean her at all, but it's just very delightful. She looks after her neighbor, feeding him. She delights in little things in life, such as replicating little dances that she saw on the TV. Just, you know, a very, very quirky but likable character, which we see in Amelie. She even has a somewhat similar look about her.
Yeah, the film felt very multicultural. We had a couple different languages being thrown around. We had different, like, cultural issues being discussed. We had different cultural components with the music. It's very interesting. It probably means something, but having just seen it, I'm not sure what it means.
True, and that much sign language, I know the character is not deaf, but it was probably nice for them to get sign language in a movie.
Yeah, that does seem like an underutilized part of filmmaking. I know we've kind of seen like a rise of sign language in TV on shows like The Fosters.
True.
No, Switched at Birth, not The Fosters.
Yeah.
Switched at Birth features a deaf character who uses sign language, and then everyone around her kind of communicates in sign language. I really like how they subtitled her.
Yeah.
Because you know, because there's a difference between how they subtitle the Russians when they're talking, which is just like how you would classically subtitle something, which is at the bottom of the screen. When they were subtitling Eliza, they put it like right next to her, almost like a speech bubble. And I just thought that was nice. Like, I thought it like connected her words to her. And it kind of like it personalized them as her words, not just some words being said, which I thought was nice. And I kind of got to play with the rhythm of those in scenes like where she's confronting Richard Jenkins' character.
Yeah.
Where they kind of utilize that personalization of the subtitles to kind of dramatically time when we get the information about what she's saying. And I mean, like, it goes along with, while, like, it coincides with her signing. But they could have very easily just given us, here's the sentence she's saying. But they time it to match when she's signing, so we get that, we get the sense of, I don't know, we get an actual delivery with the subtitles, which is cool.
That's true. Yeah, and what a performance that Sally Hawkins gave.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a person that can't speak.
Yeah, I think we talked about this in the Oscars episode. Because neither of us had seen Shape of Water when we recorded that.
True.
But we were both speculating that Sally Hawkins had to have given a pretty great performance. And how you kind of have to when you don't have dialogue to lean on. How you're kind of forced to become more physically engaged with the material. And I think she did a really good job.
Yeah, do you think that this performance might get her that Best Actress? I know we had different ideas.
I don't know. Like, I'm still not sure, because there were a lot of good performances, and I'm sure, because I still haven't seen this, but I'm sure Frances McDormand gave a great performance in Three Billboards. Did Margot Robbie get nominated for I, Tonya?
I believe so.
I'm less sure about her getting anything than I was before. I don't know how sure I was when we talked about it before, but I'm pretty sure she's not going to get it whatsoever. Just like hearing people talk about the film, like, it seems like a good film, and like they did a good job with it, but I can't see her performance being groundbreaking enough.
That's true. And I know he's not going to get any attention, but as always, we have Doug Jones as a character that doesn't talk and is not human. We get that in the Hellboy movies. He also plays kind of a amphibian guy. And then in Pan's Labyrinth, he plays Pan. He just does a very good job at using his body to kind of show an otherness. Which, yeah. I especially like comparing this to his job in Hellboy. Because they're both aquatic humanoids, but they're different.
Right.
This one's a lot more animalistic, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's a lot of properness in Abe Sapien in Hellboy. On a side little fun trivia note, I know a guy that directed him in a short film right here in Iowa.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Michael Bergen. He directed him in the short film My Friend Max.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, just kind of nice. I've heard. And he got to be not in a creature suit.
Like a human.
Basically.
How nice for him.
Yeah,
you know. No, I've heard that's a cute movie.
Yeah, it's very, very good.
So, I don't remember all the categories that this is nominated for, because we don't have the list in front of us. But, if you remember any, what do you think of the nominations that it was given? I think it was given, like, 13 nominations?
Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely.
What do you think about those now? Because I know it was given things for, like, costume design? Or makeup and hair. Film of the year. Or best film, what have you.
Best picture.
Best picture. I don't know these things.
Best director. Best
director, best actress. Best supporting actress? Yeah. Best supporting actor. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, it kind of swept the categories for getting nominated. I think that...
Best score. Best original score, yeah.
I still am holding to my guns, even though I hadn't heard the score before tonight. But I still think that this is going to go to Alexander Desplat.
It was a really good score, yeah.
If that's how you say his name. I'm guessing it's not.
We still don't know. I don't know if I agree completely with you saying that he will definitely get the Oscar, but I agree that it was a really good score.
Yeah, it's kind of favored to get the top two, the best director and the best picture. It seems that a lot of the odds are in its favor, especially with the Golden Globe Awards going as they did for it.
I don't know if it'll get Best Picture.
No? From what I understand, the competition's kind of leaning towards it or Three Billboards, but it seems like all the other awards this season have had it going to The Shape of Water.
I don't know. There's something about it that, like, it's a really good film, but I don't know if I would call it, like, Best Picture. And I don't judge the Oscars, so it really doesn't matter. But I guess this is part of the issue, though. Like, it felt too much like a genre film for me to consider it Best Picture. And yeah, maybe that's an issue that needs to be addressed in giving genre films the same consideration. But it was really fantasy. It was a fantasy film. And it would be really weird, I think, to have this fantasy film get Picture of the Year. Or yeah. Whatever. Best Picture.
Best Picture. Yeah, it seems to be drawing a lot from the old sci-fi and horror films of the 30s through the 50s, especially the obvious one being Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
We get a lot of specific notes towards it. The creature still comes from South America. It still originally was in the Amazon, the Amazon River, and it's still captured by some white men going down to South America.
Classic white man.
Yeah,
move.
To get a creature that's the last of its kind. And in Creature from the Black Lagoon, we have the creature grabbing a woman and running off with her for the men to have to come in and save the day. It's very like King Kong and like, you know, a bunch of other films where the monster wants a woman. However, in Guillermo del Toro's turn, the woman is after the monster.
She very much is. She wants that amphibian dick from, like, moment number one. She gives him her egg, dude. But yeah, no, she definitely makes a move to go after him. It's not just him swiping her off her feet. They actually form a relationship together where they seem to be on equal playing field. Which is interesting when you have a godlike amphibian character and a human woman.
Yeah, they kind of add a bit into the mix by giving him some different abilities. Like, yeah. He has some healing powers. This time in the Amazon, he's worshipped as a god by the locals, at least according to what might be an unreliable...
source.
Yeah, source.
The antagonist of the film.
Yeah, but it seems like it goes with the character, so I'll feel that that's probably an appropriate thing that he gleaned from his time in the Amazon.
Uh-huh.
And I think they handled some of the more delicate sexual things pretty well. They kind of had the creature start to touch her lightly. Then she goes away. She's unsure what to do.
Right.
Should you have sex with a half-fish man?
Who's to say?
It's a lot that she had to process. But then she comes in, she strips down. We cut away. And it's very clear they did it. It's very clear to us. It's clear to Octavia Spencer.
Who did not need shit to know what happened.
She could tell by the look on her face that Eliza was doing the fish man.
Stupping the fish man.
Yeah. Which, I kind of like that scene because it allows... The audience is going to wonder how. The audience sees that there's a flat-genitaled fish man and is going to ask questions.
Yeah, he's very Ken doll-like. You don't really see anything down there, so you're like, I know what just happened. I know what that means when the camera does that, but how the fuck does that happen? And right. Yeah, Octavia Spencer has no fucking clue. So we get to learn from this, like, weird, fun little moment in which Eliza tries to communicate what happened with her hands, and it looks like something that would have looked very weird had it actually been put on screen for us.
That's true. I'm glad we didn't see it. I think it would have just felt kind of goofy.
Yeah.
Too gross, maybe.
I don't
know.
Goofy, yeah.
I don't know how it would have looked.
We would have ended up body shaming the Aquaman. That's not what he is, but we'll call it the Aquaman. You know,
I think he's credited as Amphibian Man.
We would have ended up body shaming the Amphibian Man, and then we would have been even more kink shaming on Eliza, and it's just, it's a whole mess of stuff. So yeah, we came out all the better not seeing the aforementioned Amphibian Man genitalia.
That's true, and there's something very, very tender about how he touches her,
yeah.
Despite being a large clawed creature that has previously bitten off someone's fingers.
And will later slash a man's throat.
That's true.
Yeah, he, like, and with the same body part, too. Like, he, at the end, super spoilers, not that we've cared up until this point, but he slashes Strickland's throat, just very cleanly, without thought. But with that same hand, quote-unquote, he then, like, even immediately after that, very gently touches Eliza. And like, he has the whole film.
And it's also the same hand that he's used to do some of his miracle powers.
Yes.
Which kind of adds to the slight thematic thing of him being a godlike figure.
Yeah.
Able to both heal and take away life.
He even, like, heals himself and, like, comes back, like a Jesus moment.
That's true. It's,
which is interesting.
It's very odd stuff.
Yeah.
A very odd element of the film.
I like it, though.
Yeah, I do, too.
I like it.
What an odd film to be up for Best Picture.
Can we talk about the really odd dancing fantasy scene?
It's
like, it worked really well. But I need to talk about it.
It weirded me out going into it, and then I was like, no, this works.
Yeah, like, I get that she's using, like, the musical program she sees on TV to express what she's feeling in her fantasy. She has a nice, like, dance sequence with the Amphibian Man, which is very weird. Like, And it's just such a weird moment, but it works so well. but it's such a weird moment. It's such a weird thing. Nothing else in the film is like that scene. It's like the really long dance number at the end of Singing in the Rain, where it's like all like high class Hollywood can dancers kind of stuff, and it just doesn't fit like the rest of the film, where it's a bunch of like casual people casually learning how to be musical. This was kind of like that, except it was people in the 60s being poor suddenly being fabulous and dancing around on a stage.
That's true, and one being a monster.
A monster, yeah, you know. Yeah, that small detail.
It's very lovingly played, kind of a nice turn, dramatic indie fantasy turn.
Yeah.
On just kind of B films, which makes sense because of Del Toro's fascination with monster movies. There was recently a touring exhibit of the different art and sculptures and figures that is just in Guillermo del Toro's house, of different monsters and different just supernatural things from old films.
Yeah.
There was a lot of different figures from his own movies, and there was also, for example, some animation cells from Sleeping Beauty, where the dragon scene is.
Oh, yeah.
And then just several different things from throughout cinema that shows this guy's treating these things lovingly, and he's invigorating it with some respect.
Yeah.
And we get that not just through this film, but kind of in the context of all of his movies, really. His first film being Kronos, I know it's not one you've seen.
Right.
But is kind of a twist on the vampire tale, which we also get in Blade 2, I think a little underrated as far as Del Toro movies go. And in his TV show, The Strain, which he started in.
I heard that was really good.
I at least liked the first season. I haven't watched a lot else into it.
Uh-huh.
Though I've certainly been meaning to. It's also based on a book that he co-wrote with somebody.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's one of the monsters, and then we go into Pan's Labyrinth, which is a little more storybook fantasy, but we still get a big cast of monsters, and then Hellboy is basically populated with monsters.
Yeah.
Troll hunters, a bunch of monsters. So this is a guy that knows his monsters.
Yeah, and he loves them, and he wants to showcase them, and showcase, like... What are you laughing at me for?
I in my head, connected Guillermo del Toro loving monsters to Eliza really loving a monster.
Ah, so and what you're saying is Guillermo del Toro is projecting himself into Eliza. And really, this whole film is just an allegory for how much he loves monsters that we glean through Eliza fucking a fishman.
I feel that's not true.
I want it to be true so bad. If nothing else in this life, I want to sit down with Guillermo del Toro and be like, hey man, do you love monsters enough to just like fuck them? And he'd be like, yeah, that's what Shape of Water was all about.
How did no one get that?
Yeah, why are you the only person that got that? I'll be like, it's because I know, man. We're the same person.
He seems only delightful in interviews, so I'm sure sitting down with him would just be a great time.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say, so I doubt he'd want to fuck a fish man. I was like, no. Eliza was delightful.
That's between them and the fishmen, the respective fishmen in their lives.
Very true.
I really hope that since this movie's getting so much critical acclaim, and since Pacific Rim at least did well overseas, and well enough here to get a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think quite as well as the studios were hoping for.
Right.
I think with this recent success, I'm really hoping he starts being able to do some of the films he's wanted to do.
Like?
There's just one example I can think of, but he's tried for probably over a decade now to release an adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft story called At the Mountains of Madness, which is at least from his vision, would be an R-rated film, it would have to have a pretty decent-sized budget.
Oh, yeah.
And
If you're making Lovecraft monsters, yeah.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of troubles with that. Yeah. And I've heard there's been a lot of other projects that he's written and tried to get off the ground that he just couldn't do because he makes smaller art films mostly.
Yeah.
Pan's Labyrinth was his biggest critical success, and it was a little lower budget. The Hellboy movies, he stretched that budget like no one. Like, that's crazy how he was able to do so much with just a moderately sized budget.
Yeah.
But I really hope he's going to start getting a little more, I guess, respect.
Respect. A little more aid his way.
Yeah, and if not just respect, at least some money.
Yeah. You know, who needs respect when you can have money?
Yeah, that's true.
That's what film's all about, kids.
Yeah, it's just nice to see good things happening to good artists.
That's true. I do love when good things happen to good people.
So going back to the influences behind this film, I know you mentioned to me that you noticed a lot of allusions to the original The Little Mermaid story.
Yes.
The Hans Christian Andersen story.
Yes. So I don't know how familiar people are with the original Little Mermaid, but essentially it's a really sad story about Little Mermaid falling in love with a prince, and she's granted legs to try and seduce him or try to get him to fall in love with her so that they can at least live similar lives. But I believe she still is robbed of her voice, and additionally, it always feels like she's stepping on, like, needles, which is weird. And she ends up not being with the prince, I think because she's given the decision to save his life or let him die. So she chooses to save his life and then, by being killed herself. And then she becomes, like, an immortal fairy that, like, lives forever, like, helping people or something like that. It's been a bit since I've read it. But, like, long story short, it's super different from the Disney version in that there's no happy ending. And it's really fucking sad and bizarre. And also that it didn't really start out as, like, a children's story. It started out as Hans Christian's perhaps vengeful last love letter to a man he'd been in love with who got engaged to a woman. So basically he just wanted to write him, like, a sad little story about unrequited love. So that all ties into this movie for me in that we have some of these themes present. Some of them are really little. Like, we have the characters complaining about their feet hurting a lot, which is logical, because they're cleaning women, and they're on their feet all day, and they don't have arch support, and they don't have mats beneath their feet to make sure their feet don't hurt. But it just comes up a lot. It comes up a lot how much their feet hurt. And I just think it's an interesting parallel and, like, an interesting callback to that story. We also have, like, the unrequited love aspect, in which Richard Jenkins' character attempts attempts to get to know this man who works at a pie shop that he's been crushing on, but the guy's like, hey, fuck off, because it's the 60s and gay guys aren't quite that okay yet. But yeah, we have that idea of, you know, unrequited love, specifically unrelated homosexual love. And then we have this idea of immortality or second life or extended life or rebirth, like you and I were talking about earlier. Both the amphibian man and Eliza seem to die, but both are brought back and given new life at the end through the actions of the amphibian man, calling back to that being through the actions of the Little Mermaid in Hans Christian Andersen's tale. So, like, I don't know for sure that this movie was coming, was inspired a lot by the original Little Mermaid, but there's just a lot of interesting callbacks and parallels that I noticed.
Yeah, and it certainly wouldn't be unusual for Guillermo del Toro to be referencing old fairy tales. It was a big part of Pan's Labyrinth, his other largely critical success. There's also a couple other odd similarities between the two movies. You get a guy that from the beginning, you know, is a bad guy. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of build-up in Pan's Labyrinth to that character, and then in this movie, there's just something about the lighting and the score and maybe his costume that as soon as Michael Shannon enters the room, you're like, wow, that guy is just bad an news. A-hole, yeah. We also get one of the heroes of the story injuring the bad guy, which we have the nice big cut on the face of the bad guy in Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the fingers wounded for Michael Shannon in The Shape of Water. So we get a lot of odd little similarities in the bad guy predominantly. Both are given a good amount of backstory,
mm-hmm.
so that you maybe not empathize with them, but you certainly kind of understand their mindset.
Yeah. And Pan's Labyrinth took place during war times as well, right?
Yeah, it would have taken place during the Spanish Civil War, so like the 30s and 40s.
I mean, so that's cool. That's interesting.
Yeah, both are period pieces, I guess, yeah. What we can get there.
And both kind of use, or, like, parallel that kind of tension with, like, living during political tension.
True.
What that means in your own life.
Yeah, and there's also, at the more surface level, a comparison between, we get a lot of grisliness in both films.
Yeah.
Against also very beautiful scenes.
Yeah.
Speak
on that.
Some of the more beautiful scenes that I can think of are a lot of the underwater shots in The Shape of Water. A lot of nice flowiness. The opening of the film, while kind of darker, we get a view around her whole apartment as if it were underwater.
That was really cool.
That was really
cool.
That was
a great opening.
And then later she stops up her bathroom door so she can flood the whole of her bathroom.
And the theater below.
And the theater below gets some water damage, too. So it's just, there's a big kind of stretch between beautiful imagery and very grisly imagery. Because not only is there the injuries that the bad guy gets, but there's also the creature eating a cat. And there's...
That was real graphic and
weird. Yeah, everyone in the theater went,
God.
As soon as the cat was revealed.
They were really casual about that cat being dead. He was like, oh, hey, sorry, one of our cats is dead. Oops.
I mean, that guy knows. He was like, it's a wild animal's gonna eat a cat.
Right, yeah. He even says that. He's like, no, it's just his nature.
Yeah, which is a little weird, because he's also given the level of sentience that we're okay with him having a romantic sexual relationship.
But he also eats cats, and that's fine.
Well.
But he's also like a healing god, and that's fine. So this amphibian man is crossing many thresholds.
He's complex. He fills a lot of shoes. I also think that maybe in part because he doesn't speak, we get a lot of characters projecting things on to this amphibian man.
Yeah.
There's the whole scene of the gay character that Richard Jenkins plays. Just kind of comparing himself to the fish monster. They're both at odds with the societies around them. And then
Eliza spends like the whole movie empathizing with the amphibian man and kind of projecting herself onto him as well.
That's true. And then also even Michael Shannon, the bad guy, kind of by the end of it, at the very end of it, I suppose, sees him as the native saw him, as a god, which is interesting considering he's painted to be a very religious man throughout the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting for him to seem to recognize some kind of divinity in this very unorthodox creature. It's an interesting way for his character to end.
That's true.
The world kind of unfolds around him, just in time for him to bite the dust.
Yeah.
Which is a nice scene. I appreciate him suffering in that scene. Especially since he dealt that out a couple scenes earlier, really grotesquely. So it was nice to see him kind of get a taste of his own medicine at the end of that.
Speaking of rather grotesquely, you're referring to when he rips off his own gangrenous fingers.
Oh, I was talking about when he is, like, sticking his hand in Dimitri's wounds. And
oh, that's true.
Yeah. But yes, he also does rip off his own fingers that had previously been bitten off and put back on, merely for a dramatic effect, it seems.
I mean, it certainly got someone talking and giving him information. Oh,
Bruce is such a fucker.
Brewster.
Yeah. She calls him Bruce.
Oh, okay.
For context, Zelda, Octavia Spencer's character, has a just bumfuck husband who just sits around doing nothing. And the first something he does in the film is sell out Eliza.
He's worried about his wife, though.
He's not worried about his wife.
He's worried about his wife.
Oh my god, if he was worried about his wife, he would have stepped that man. That is a regular man.
Yeah, but we're especially shown the different racial tensions that's going on at this time. I don't know if a black man's going to feel comfortable directly having an altercation with a white man.
That's very true. I just saw nothing or heard nothing from Bruce's character that would lead me to believe that he was like, oh, I have to protect my wife.
I mean, he says that, though. He says, well, just don't hurt my wife. I'll tell you.
He just seems lazy to me. He seems lazy and kind of mean, and I hate him. But I do agree that the racial tensions of the time would play into his motivation for what he does next. I definitely think that's at play there.
Yeah, and I really like that we see pretty early on him getting his fingers removed, and then they're put back on surgically. And while his world is falling around him, his fingers start to get worse. We mostly notice them getting worse after the creature disappears from his lab. And then slowly, his world's crumbling around him. His car gets wrecked. That's the first thing, really. His job security is put, maybe even life security. I wasn't sure whether the general was threatening just to fire him or to murder him.
He said there would be a Michael Shannon's character shaped hole in the universe.
That does imply death.
Right? Like, I was like, oh, this bitch gonna die. Okay, I guess you better do your job then. Like, holy shit.
Right? But it just kind of, to me, showed a parallel visually.
Yeah.
To what was actually happening in his life.
Yeah, and then he finally snaps, and then literally snaps his fingers off.
That's true.
It's a very nice moment.
Yeah, I also like that we get the American chain of command being awful.
Yeah.
Like, the government entities, the generals, terrible. Michael Shannon's terrible. And then we get the Russians, the Soviets, and they're about to kill their own guy.
Yeah.
They do, in effect, kill their own guy. Like, they leave him shot for dead.
I mean, they would have killed him
better. Yeah, they would have finished killing him.
Except Michael Shannon was like, nuh-uh, coming in here, I'm finger gunning. For those of you who can't see, because you're listening to this. But yeah, they're also awful. So we get this, like, anti-institution.
That's true.
Kind of sense, too.
It would have felt odd for the Americans to to be awful, and then the Soviets to have saved the day.
That would have been weird.
Which I felt was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't know how I feel about the Soviets maybe saving the day. They were really awful real life.
That would take a lot of balls on Guillermo del Toro's end.
Yeah, and I think they played that perfectly.
They did, yeah. They gave us Dimitri's character, who at heart is a scientist. He's not a Soviet or a spy or an American or any of the things he pretends to be or any of the things he has to be. He's a scientist. And all of his motivations are kind of driven by that.
So that's true.
I thought that was a nice way to kind of balance what he was doing.
Yeah, there's basically nice guys and bad guys on both sides.
Yeah, I liked that. I liked that a lot. So, we might have touched on this earlier, but I just want to know, what would your argument be for this winning Best Picture?
Well, unfortunately, with Best Picture, as well as most of the Oscar categories, you get into the realm of also having to deal with not just the quality of the movie, but also some other things. And in the case with The Shape of Water, I think that other thing is Guillermo del Toro being a pretty established filmmaker, and one that hasn't garnered that much in terms of recognition and awards. One that's a nice figure to win Best Picture. You have an immigrant to America, a Mexican director who came about the same time as Iñárritu and Cuarón. And Iñárritu, I'm probably saying his name wrong, both came about around the same time. Del Toro started a little earlier, but they were kind of known as the Three Amigos, is what America dubbed them.
Ahaha.
Yeah, because there's three, and they're from Mexico, so the Three Amigos.
Hey, America. Yay. Look at you.
Anyway.
With
Iñárritu having success with Birdman and The Revenant, and then with Cuarón having commercial and critical success with Gravity, and also pretty good critical success with Children of Men and Y Tu Mama Tambien. They also let him direct Harry Potter and The Prisoner of Azkaban. So these other filmmakers are getting a lot of attention, both commercially and critically, whereas Del Toro has kind of had to languish a bit, despite being one of the originators out of the three of them of success.
Yeah.
He had his hits, which weren't even that big of hits because they were so early in the movement. And then kind of had to wait a bit, maybe because he was using this time to play more with what he loved, like the Hellboy films and that TV show,
The Strain. Yeah.
And Troll Hunters. And
he just has really big ideas that I think take a lot of time. And that might be part of why it's taken so long for him to garner this much buzz.
That's true. So I guess, long story short, since the question is the film going to win? I think they're going to take into account Del Toro's history. And, you know, since this is already at least a great film, I think it will win. And then its big competition would maybe be Three Billboards, because it's such a touching story that a lot of people are enjoying as a film. And also Lady Bird, because it's also gotten a lot of critical success.
All right. Well, we will see.
We will see.
We will see. You make some very good points. I can't really argue those points. I'm still dubious as to if Shape of Water will get an Oscar.
It is a little too true to its genre roots.
It's very genre specific.
Which I don't...
And it's very sexual.
That's true.
It's extremely sexual. Like, Moonlight was super political. But it wasn't very sexual.
Yeah, despite there being a masturbation scene that's primarily out of focus and lasts a couple of seconds into the beginning.
There's another one, too.
Yeah, there's two, but both are about the same.
Yeah.
The second one being even shorter than the first. But Del Toro, I saw, had to make a statement on it that was worthy of an article in Variety.
Yeah, like, which, he had to defend putting that in there.
Yeah, it's very weird.
It's very weird. But I think it's stuff like that that counts against it.
That's fair.
Unfortunately. And it's stuff like that that makes me want it to win, because I want a film like this to win, a film that's so genuine and so full of heart and is so risky in the way it treats sexuality, especially female sexuality, on screen. But yeah, I now want it to win more than I did before. I would really like it if it won. I'm just not sure if it's going to. But I will put my hope out for it.
There you go. Well, it's been nice talking with you about Shape of Water. We probably forgot all kinds of things to say about it.
Oh, yeah.
But we just saw it. This is a very fresh take.
Yeah.
So, it's been great talking with you about it. And, you know, let's hope it does well.
Yeah, let's hope.
Till next time, everybody.